Good morning, my friends, and welcome to yet another incredible installment of the program. From very high above all the puerile and vacuous forms of Wyoming mainstream media, this is Cowboy State Politics. I, of course, am your illustrious host, David Iverson, firmly and permanently ensconced behind the silver Cowboy State Politics microphone and broadcasting to you from the base of the Bighorns at the Cowboy State Politics Northern Command Studio in Sheridan, Wyoming. Good morning, my friends, and welcome to this special Thanksgiving Day installment of the program. As longtime listeners of the program know, I look forward to this episode each and every year. On this one day, I get to correct a lie that each and every person that went through the American school system has been told, and frankly, is still being told, the real story of Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving Day is a holiday that is unique to America, and unlike any other, it has been perverted by the Marxist American left since the first homogenized American school was set up. No longer are school children taught the true origins of the first Thanksgiving at the Plymouth Colony. And so, every Thanksgiving Day, I correct the record. But before we do any of that, there's a couple of things that we ought to discuss. On November 10th, some 31 members of the Wyoming legislature sent a letter to Governor Mark Gordon asking him to debate the merits of his climate change agenda. Specifically, the governor was challenged on his claims that CO2 is a pollutant that we ought to capture and sequester and get rid of, and that it's completely harming everything on planet Earth. From their November 10th letter, and I quote, "On behalf of the people of Wyoming, who unquestionably deserve a say in whether or not our state turns its back on fossil fuels in favor of green energy, we challenge you and your designated representatives to a face-to-face, public, fair, and factual debate on the issues of climate change and the purported contribution to it from CO2. Eminent scientists from the CO2 Coalition will present objective facts in the debate to disprove your views on these issues. Membership of the CO2 Coalition includes some of the most prominent scientists in the world. We urge you to name your own qualified scientist participants to present your side of the debate. While climate alarmists claim to act based on science, oddly, they do not encourage or join in debate with those who have different views. We believe that in Wyoming, we are better than that. The people of Wyoming deserve an open and robust conversation on this issue to hear both sides of the CO2 debate and then decide for themselves. Wyoming's future is not yours to decide alone. Enough trading barbs via radio interviews, letters to the editor, and comments to reporters, none of which can be answered concurrently by the other side. We believe that all Wyomingites will most benefit from a real in-depth discussion of these issues. It is time for a fair debate at a neutral location with a neutral moderator of your choosing." End quote. Given that Governor Gordon believes so fervently in climate change, you would think that he would jump at the opportunity to debate some knuckle-dragging idiot conservatives who don't believe that the world is warming. And he did. To the Cow Pie, in an article entitled "Mark Gordon Accepts Challenge from Wyoming Lawmaker for Climate Change Debate," dated the very same day as the letter. And I quote, "Michael Perlman, a spokesman for Gordon, said the governor is willing to debate. He also said Steinmetz's letter and email introducing the letter to her fellow legislators was completely inaccurate, deliberately misleading, and mixed characterizes Gordon's views on fossil fuels and green energy." Quote, "Despite the inaccuracies raised in the email and letter, the governor is happy to entertain an opportunity to properly present his position on carbon capture usage and storage in a public forum focused on finding solutions to keeping our core industries viable and not just political grandstanding," Perlman said. End quote. So at that point, the gauntlet had been thrown down and picked up by the climate change warrior Mark Gordon. At that point, the only thing left to do would be to decide on a date, pick a moderator, and take UW up on their gracious invitation to host the debate. Now, there is some question as to the governor's record on his support of fossil fuels. I have played numerous times on the program his comments at Harvard University. Here's what he said.
And I know what's happening on the environmental side. We've had several glaciers that have been delisted as glaciers in the West. It is clear that we have a warming climate. It is clear that carbon dioxide is a major contributor to that challenge. There is an urgency to addressing this issue. And it isn't going to be solved only by turning off fossil fuels.
Did you catch what he said? It isn't going to be solved only by turning off fossil fuels, which would mean that it is going to include turning off fossil fuels. Here it is again, just so you don't forget.
It isn't going to be solved only by turning off fossil fuels.
Got it. Now, in case you think that I'm cherry-picking one comment out of one speech, he said the exact same thing in Gillette at a Western Governors Association meeting. Here's that soundbite.
And so it takes a real degree of courage to understand that trying to shut down fossil fuels does not necessarily address decarbonizing.
It doesn't necessarily address decarbonizing, which would mean, at some degree, that turning off fossil fuels would address decarbonizing. So the only person who's really mischaracterizing Governor Gordon's position is Governor Gordon himself. And by the way, it either takes a tremendous amount of courage or a tremendous amount of stupidity to say that kind of stuff in Gillette. 10 days later, after Governor Gordon's spokesman, Michael Perlman, accepted the debate challenge, he sent a letter to all of the members of the Wyoming legislature bowing out of the debate that he had already said he would participate in. And I quote, "Thank you for the letter some of you signed and the opportunity to set the record straight. Respectfully, I would suggest the nonsensical allegations that I have changed my tune on our coal, oil, and natural gas industries are either craven misrepresentations of my record on the topic for venal political gain or complete ignorance of my commitment to defend our core industries against all comers, regardless of national climate policy." End quote. Craven misrepresentations of my record on the topic for venal political gain or complete ignorance of my commitment. It would appear that Governor Gordon has discovered a dictionary. I have one too, Governor. On yesterday's installment of the live program, I promised you an interview with someone that hardly anybody else could set up, Noah Webster. The only problem is, the guy has been pushing up daisies for 180 years. However, I do own a copy of his 1828 American Dictionary of the English Language. As far as interviews go, that's about as close as you're going to get to Noah Webster. Let's see here. Cramp, crank, crapulence, there's a good one. Craven, weak or cowardly. It seems to me that the only person who is acting cowardly, cravenly, is the governor himself. He did, after all, accept a debate challenge and then 10 days later decide that that was not a good idea and sent a nasty letter back to the legislature declining their invitation. What about venal? Let's see here. Vegetable. Velication. That's fascinating. Venality. The state of being influenced by money. Prostitution of talents, offices, or services for money or reward. There's an awful lot of money tied up in this whole climate change agenda. And it would seem to me that tying an office such as governor of the state of Wyoming to that source of money might be considered prostituting one's office. The trouble with using words that you don't quite understand is sometimes they get turned around on you. As it's pretty clear that the governor, or one of his aides, has been thumbing through a dictionary, allow me to provide a couple of other words that perhaps they should look up. Impetuous, implausible, and imperious, which is exactly what the governor's climate change agenda and his insulting letter to the legislature is. Our pal Rod Miller from the Cowpie had a different take on this whole Mark Gordon letter and refusing to debate after he had agreed to debate situation. And I quote, "Maybe the Freedom Caucus's mind is made up and facts won't change that. could be that such a debate would descend into a knuckle-dragging rhetorical bar fight, and no light would be shed on the topic at hand. But give me a break. Saying you'll duke it out and then backing down? Gordon, in doing so, is no better than the shopkeepers and accountants who wring their hands about right and wrong, but don't have the balls to step out onto the street with Will Cain. Any respect I had for the man as a political leader vanished with his "let's get it on," followed by his "no mas." Maybe he just wasn't cut out to be a cowboy. This has nothing to do with the relative merits of Gordon's and the Freedom Caucus's views on global warming. This has everything to do with the governor, who is supposed to articulate the policy of this state, not standing up on his hind legs and defending that policy in front of God and all the people of Wyoming. This is Mark Gordon not having the courage to walk out into the street for a face-off. Rod ends his column in saying, quote, "I don't give a rat's ass what office Governor Gordon runs for next, but there sure as hell won't be one of his campaign signs in my yard. I'll step out onto the street myself and put a screeching halt to that nonsense." End quote. The truth is that Mark Gordon did what all redcoats do. It's all buff and bluster until it's time to throw down, and then they back off and slink off to some other corner. Politicians need to have the courage of their convictions. It's pretty clear that Mark Gordon believes in this climate change mumbo-jumbo. So stick up for what you believe in, pal. In any case, it's clear that the conservative members of the legislature won this shootout, and they didn't even have to drop the hammer once. They came out smelling like a rose. And as for Mark Gordon, he appeared as weak and ineffectual as many people already believe he is. I suggest that we all consider this little spat between the governor and the conservatives in the legislature as our own Thanksgiving Day quarrel. Leave our political arguments to the politicians and enjoy the company of our families. As it relates to Thanksgiving, up next, the Cowboy State Politics Thanksgiving Day tradition, the real story of Thanksgiving. But first, an absolutely obscene profit timeout. This special presentation of Cowboy State Politics is brought to you by Morton Buildings. If you've been thinking about a building for your property, whether it's a barn or a roping arena, or maybe you need a giant warehouse for your business, the two guys to talk to are Nick and Jesse at Morton Buildings. One of the things they do differently than other companies is they set concrete pillars with steel beams inside them. That way, there's no way that water can collect at the base of your building. These concrete pillars provide exceptional stability for all of your metal buildings. So it doesn't really matter what type of building you're thinking about, give Nick and Jesse a call. Their phone number is 307-674-2532, or you can check them out at their website at mortonbuildings.com. One of the things that I'm enormously thankful for is my enormous gun collection. The gun collection I used to have before it was all lost in a tragic boating accident. And at Gunrunner Auctions, you can find just about any firearm you want to replace the gun collection that you also lost in a boating accident. This week's gun of the week is lot number 398. It's a Stevens 22 caliber pump action rifle. It's a must-have for any 22 caliber collector. It's in good condition. It's got a 20-inch round barrel that has a fair bore with some rifling and darkness and a little bit of corrosion, but it's still an excellent piece. The blue finish has been turned mostly patina from age with peppering on the barrel and the receiver, and it also has some hits to the metal on the receiver. But this is a classic, so it's bound to have a little bit of wear. The action works just fine. It's got a lined wood forearm and smooth wood stock are in great shape with a little bit of finish wear and impressions in the stock. It would be a great addition to your collection, and it can be yours. It's lot number 398 at thegunrunner.com. And now, back to the program. One One of the Thanksgiving traditions in my family is we all sit around and talk about the things that we're thankful for. Not stupid things like you were able to buy a motorcycle or a new gun, but the things that we are truly thankful for. So here's a couple of mine. I'm thankful to all of you who listen each and every day to the program. I'm thankful for all of the sponsors of Cowboy State Politics that make all of this possible. And I'm eternally thankful that all of us live in this amazing country that allows us to do things like this so that we can have conversations free from government interference, so that we can worship in the way that we choose, and that we can hang out with whomever we want. And we wouldn't have any of that if not for the Plymouth Colony. And the day that we're going to celebrate tomorrow, Thanksgiving Day, is a tradition that was started at the Plymouth Colony. But unfortunately, most of our students are lied to about it. And so, without further ado, the real story of Thanksgiving.
I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast that a lot of our holidays have turned into nothing more than consumerism. Think about it. In October, the stores start rolling out all of the Christmas stuff onto their shelves. In October, no less. That's quite an insult to Thanksgiving, if you ask me. And even Thanksgiving, after we wake up from our turkey coma, the very first thing we do is see which stores we're going to spend all of our hard-earned cash at. And Thanksgiving itself. We were all probably told that a bunch of hapless religious objectors boarded a rickety boat for the New World, and when they stepped off the boat at Plymouth Rock, they all would have starved had it not been for the generosity of the Indians. Because they were all too dumb to know how to farm or to fish or to how to even take care of themselves. You know, make coats or clothing or anything like that. And then when they had learned everything that the Indians had to teach them, they had this gigantic feast and they said thanks to everything that had been done for them. Before I go any further, I just want to clear up one little detail. My use of the word Indian. Now, before I'm attacked on social media, allow me to explain. The current vernacular would dictate that I use the term Native American, but I contend that the term Indian is no less derogatory than is Native American. Of course, America was named for the Italian explorer Amerigo Vespucci. Aha! So all of us Americans are actually named after an Italian explorer, no less. And the term Native? How many times has that been used in a disparaging context? Where the term Indians came around is that Christopher Columbus thought that he had landed in India, and so he referred to the people that he met when he landed as Indians. So, six of one, half a dozen the other. What I'm getting at is, in order to have an intelligent conversation, you have to put your woke crap away. It doesn't help further the conversation in any way, shape, or form, and frankly, it's pretty stupid. So, in an attempt to be as historically accurate as I could possibly be, we're just going to stick with the historical context and leave all of you woke warriors to go home to your safe space. So, Thanksgiving. What very nearly killed the Pilgrims was not their ignorance of farming or fishing or making their own clothes, but their ignorance of economics. Allow me to explain. The Mayflower Compact, which was the agreement that all of the Pilgrims signed to live in the Plymouth Colony and to set up their society, did a couple of things. First of all, it said that the colonists would remain loyal subjects to King James, despite their need for self-governance, that the colonists would create and enact laws, ordinances, acts, constitutions, and offices for the good of the colony and abide by those laws. It also said that the colonists would create one society and work together to further it, and the colonists would live in accordance with the Christian faith. Sounds pretty rosy, doesn't it? Everybody's working together for the common good. Here's where things get a little bit muddy. To give you an example, an article on history.com says the following, and I quote, "It has been argued that the Mayflower Compact's role in cementing the colonists' dedication to each other and their mission was critical to their endurance that first winter. John Carver survived the hard winter of 1620, but died in April of 1621, and the colonists chose William Bradford to replace him. Under his leadership, the Plymouth Colony started to thrive." End quote. Now hold on just a second. Why did the colony start to thrive under William Bradford? nothingonhistory.com. In fact, they would lead you to believe that nothing changed, that they just changed leadership, John Carver croaked, and then William Bradford took over. But that's not the real story at all. One of the great traditions in radio around Thanksgiving is to tell the real story of Thanksgiving. And it was started by radio legend Paul Harvey. Now, of course, he wouldn't tell the whole thing on his program because his program only lasted around 4 or 5 minutes. But he'd just give you little snippets here and there. And then when Rush Limbaugh started his program, his was long enough that he could give you the whole thing. And so, on this Thanksgiving, in honor of Paul Harvey and Rush Limbaugh, I give you the real story of Thanksgiving. So here's what happened. A group of separatists left England for Holland, and they stayed there for about 11 years and set up their own community. And then they decided, about 40 of them decided, that they were going to make the journey to the New World. And they'd certainly face hardships when they got there, but they could live and worship God according to the dictates of their own consciences. You see, the folks that they met in Holland were not really as tolerant as the pilgrims first thought. So, about 40 of them decided to go to the New World. The journey to the New World was not a fun one, my friends. It was cold, nasty, and a whole bunch of them died. But when they landed in New England in November, they found, according to Bradford's own journal, a cold, barren, desolate wilderness. Quote, there were no friends to greet them. There were no inns where they could refresh themselves. There was nothing. And the sacrifice that they made for freedom was just the beginning. During that first winter, half the pilgrims, including William Bradford's wife, died of either starvation, sickness, or exposure. When spring finally came, Indians taught the settlers how to plant corn, fish, and cod, and skin beavers for coats. Life improved for the pilgrims, but they didn't prosper. This is important to understand, because this is where American school history lessons often end. Thanksgiving is actually explained in some of our classrooms as a holiday for which the pilgrims gave thanks to the Indians for saving their lives, rather than as a devout expression of gratitude grounded in the tradition of both the Old and the New Testaments. Here's the part that almost every textbook leaves out, because the textbooks are written by the teachers' union, which are mostly liberal. The original contract the pilgrims had entered into with their merchant sponsors in London called for everything they produced to go into a common store, and each member of the community was entitled to one common share. All of the land they cleared and the houses they built belonged to the community as well. It was a socialist commune, well before socialism had ever been written about by Karl Marx. What William Bradford wrote about the socialist experiment that they were embarking on should be in every single child's school history book. If it were, we might be able to prevent some needless suffering that socialism always creates. Listen close. Here is what William Bradford wrote. Quote, the experience that was had in this common course and condition tried sundry years, that by taking away property and bringing community into a commonwealth would make them happy and flourishing, as if they were wiser than God. For this community, so far as it was found to breed much confusion and discontent, and retard much employment that would have been to their benefit and comfort. For young men that were most able and fit for labor and service did repine that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without any recompense. That was thought injustice. Do you hear what he's saying? The pilgrims found out that people could not be expected to do their best work without incentive. So what did Bradford's community try next? They unharnessed the power of the good old free enterprise by invoking an ungirding capitalist principle of private property. Every family was assigned its own piece of land to work and permitted to market its own crops and products. And what was the result? Again, from William Bradford's journal. Quote, this had very good success, for it made all hands industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been. So the truth is, the same thing happened to them that happens every time socialism is tried. That you have some people that will work and some people that won't. And so, after a little bit, the people that actually did want to work, well, they're going to work less. And then everybody slips further and further into poverty. So had William Bradford not made the change to a capitalist free market enterprise, the Plymouth Colony would have never survived. Pretty soon, they would have run out of other people's food to eat. After Bradford ditched the whole idea of socialism, in no time, the Pilgrims found that they had way more food than they could eat themselves, and so they set up trading posts and exchanged goods with the Indians. The profits allowed them to pay off their debts to the merchants in London, and the success and prosperity of the Plymouth settlement attracted more Europeans and began what came to be known as the Great Puritan Migration. So now that we've filled in the gaps that History.com omitted, the rest of the story is largely true. There was a giant feast, and the Indians were invited to it, and everybody ate themselves into a turkey coma. So the truth is, Thanksgiving really is a celebration of the free market over that of a dumb socialist commune. Ah, you gotta love free market economics.
That'll about do it for my Thanksgiving Day special. Go spend some time with your family. Talk about the things that you're thankful for. And try, for once, to leave the politics to the politicians. For now, from the base of the Bighorns, at the Cowboy State Politics Northern Command Studio, happy Thanksgiving. I'm David Iverson, and this is the one and only Cowboy State Politics.